Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The Caribbean is feeling the effects of Hurricane Irma, billed as one of the most powerful storms spawned in the Atlantic Ocean. The Category 5 storm is lashing Puerto Rico with high winds and heavy rains, causing widespread outages. A local official of the French part of St. Martin said the French-Dutch ruled island is almost completely destroyed, with at least six people reported killed. The situation is the same on the two-island nation of Antigua and Barbuda, which bore the brunt of Irma earlier Wednesday. Garfield Burfield is news director of ABS-TV on Antigua.
Over 90% of the buildings there were either destroyed or severely damaged. It's almost a wipeout of what happened, a wipeout on Barbuda. From the air, the pictures are almost surreal.
He said the Prime Minister, Gaston Brown, visited Barbuda, described the island of some 1,800 as barely habitable. The storm is expected to impact the Dominican Republic, Haiti, the Turks and Caicos Islands, and the Bahamas, and could hit Florida by week's end, where Rick Scott is the governor.
We are being very aggressive in our preparation for this storm, and every Floridian should take this seriously and be aggressive to protect their family. This is serious, and we cannot take chances. Is life-threatening. This is not a storm you can sit and wait through.
Two more storms were upgraded to hurricane status Wednesday, Jose in the Atlantic and Katia in the southwest Gulf of Mexico. In Togo, tens of thousands turned out in the capital, Lomé, demanding the resignation of President Faure Gnassingbé, who's ruled since 2005, following his father, the late Gnassingbé Eyadema, who held the office for nearly 40 years. This protester demanded the return of the 1992 constitution and term limits, said the Togolese leader and his family must leave. This is VOA News. Pope Francis arrived Wednesday in Bogota, fulfilling a pledge to visit the South American country after the main rebel group signed a peace agreement with the government. After arriving at the papal nuncio's residence, he called on the crowd to pray for him. The Pope's five-day visit is billed as one of peace and unity following more than five decades of armed resistance. The Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, last year agreed to disarm and advance their cause through the political system. UN Syria peace envoy Stefan de Mistura Wednesday said given events on the ground, the country is facing a moment of truth. He pointed to a U.S.-backed rebel effort to liberate Raqqa from Islamic State and the breaking of an IS siege around Deir al-Zor by Syrian and allied forces.
The military situation has been improving, but it's time to negotiate. And for the opposition to do the same in a realistic, unified way, that is going to be very soon, after Raqqa and Deir al-Zor.
De Mistura asked if the opposition to President Bashar al-Assad is preparing to accept that they did not win the war in Syria. But he stopped short of saying the regime won. He did call on both sides to engage in serious dialogue next month. Also Wednesday, UN investigators concluded the Syrian government was responsible for last April's sarin gas attack on the village of Khan Sheikhoun that killed more than 80 civilians. President Donald Trump said while the time for talking with North Korea is over, the use of military force is not his first option. Mr. Trump spoke by phone with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping, who insisted dialogue is the way to defuse Korean tensions over its nuclear missile programs. Sung-Yoon Lee is a Tufts University Korea analyst.
What Trump is referring to is the kind of concessionary diplomacy negotiations that the U.S. and South Korea and others have been engaged in for the past 20 years. So, yes, there will come a time for talks, but not right now. We need to put more non-lethal financial sanctions on North Korea.
Meanwhile, the U.S. is preparing a draft U.N. Security Council resolution calling for an oil embargo in North Korea, a freeze on foreign assets of leader Kim Jong-un, a ban on textile exports, and an end to payments to North Korean guest workers. The U.S. Wednesday slapped sanctions on two senior South Sudanese officials and the country's former army chief, as well as three companies over rights abuses, obstructing peace efforts, and corruption in the country's civil war. The sanctions will block assets in the U.S. and in the U.S. financial system. The announcement came just days after U.S. official Mark Green visited the South Sudanese capital and warned that Washington was reviewing its support of President Salva Kiir. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Thursday, September the 7th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you. The Trump administration has imposed sanctions on two senior members of South Sudan's government and the country's former army chief. Europe is entering a new phase in its response to migration in Africa, which analysts say is problematic for many reasons.
The first thing to understand is that boats are actually not leaving from Libya. Because if you look at the numbers of the rescues done by the Libyan Coast Guard, they've not gone up dramatically in July, which was the first month of the drop of the flows.
Mattia Towaldo is a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. And ongoing protests in Togo this week have drawn attention to what rights groups are saying is a crackdown on freedom of expression in the country. And in South Africa, the ruling African National Congress, ANC, is calling on Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party, the party of President Robert Mugabe, to ask its leader to abstain from making what they say are disparaging comments about the late former president Nelson Mandela.
The ANC has come out strongly, slamming Mugabe's views. ANC Secretary General Gwede Mantashe telling journalists that he phoned his counterpart, the Secretary General of ZANU-PF, to complain about his president's comments.
Nadia Sami is a reporter in Johannesburg, South Africa. We have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. The Trump administration has imposed sanctions on two senior members of South Sudan's government and the country's former army chief. The sanctions freeze any assets that Information Minister Michael Makuei-Lorth, Deputy Defense Chief Malek Robin, and former Army Chief Paul Malong, assets that they have under U.S. jurisdiction. The three are also barred from entering the United States. The U.S. also imposed sanctions on the three South Sudanese companies owned by or controlled by Robin. The State Department says it is targeting the men for their roles in threatening the peace, security, or stability of South Sudan, which is in the fourth year of a bloody civil war. Europe is entering a new phase in its response to migration from Africa, which is problematic for many reasons, argues Mattia Towaldo, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Towaldo tells Rikish Rayok that European support for Libyan armed forces not only is ethically unfair to migrants themselves, but also could backfire for Europe in terms of security concerns.
The first thing to understand is that boats are actually not leaving from Libya. Because if you look at the numbers of the rescues done by the Libyan Coast Guard, they've not gone up dramatically in July, which was the first month of the drop of the flows. So someone on the Libyan coast has decided that it's not convenient to have boats full of migrants leave to Europe. The reasons for this are different. There have been media reports about direct payments from the Italian intelligence services to the armed groups, which happen to be at the same time very close to the smugglers and in charge of security in the ports and in the coast of Libya. But most probably what's happening is that the smugglers have decided that they have more profitable activities.
The migrants who do manage to leave, as I understand it, many of them are being sent back to, or the boats are being intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard and being sent back to Libya. And many of these migrants go to detention centers. What kind of risks are the migrants facing in these detention centers?
The first pillar of the new policy is that boats don't leave Libya because the armed groups don't let them. But the second pillar deals with the situation in which a boat eventually leaves the Libyan coast. In that case, it is now, quote unquote, rescued by the Libyan Coast Guard, which has created its own search and rescue area, which goes well beyond Libyan territorial waters. They're then taken back to detention centers. Now there are official detention centers, which are between 20 and 30, and then there are unofficial warehouses where migrants are put directly. And this is where the situation gets murky, but also quite clear from the point of view of violations of human rights. Both in official detention centers and unofficial detention centers, migrants' rights are violated. Many of them report being raped. Almost all of them report being beaten. Almost all of them report being threatened with not being freed unless their family pays activities.
In your article, you said, for the moment, the mood in Europe is to keep out as many Africans as possible. Is this ethically and logistically problematic?
The reason why keeping Africans outside of Europe and in Libya is ethically unfair are pretty obvious. Many of these people would have a right to asylum and they will never be able to claim it. Many of these people would simply come to Europe to work. But the reasons why this is logistically and from a security point of view dangerous is that the current policy relies heavily on Libyan armed groups, which are highly unpredictable, which conduct other criminal activities, which may backfire against Europe. And eventually, this gives them the upper hand with the government.
Mattia Tawaldo is a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He was speaking to Ricky Shryok from London.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz. 19.2 meter band.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. Right here on VOA Africa.
In South Africa, the ruling African National Congress, the ANC, is calling on Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party, the party of President Robert Mugabe. They're asking Mugabe's party to tell its leader to abstain from making what they say disparaging comments about the late former president of South Africa, Nelson Mandela. The calls by the ANC follow President Mugabe's recent comments at a celebration of Heroes Day in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, where he accused Mandela of allowing white people in South Africa to take all the lands. Mugabe's comments and backlash come hot on the heels of a recent diplomatic spat involving Zimbabwe's First Lady Grace Mugabe, where she was accused of assaulting a young lady in a South African hotel. From Johannesburg, South Africa, I reached Nadia Sami to tell us what's going on between the two friendly countries.
Well, Jackson, South Africa's governing party, the ANC, has hit back at comments by Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe about the late Nelson Mandela. It's not the first time Mugabe ruffles feathers here in this way. Mandela is one of South Africa's most loved politicians. He's still seen as a uniting and noble figure who largely enjoys respect from most groups across South Africa. The public here feeling that the latest comments by Mugabe is nothing but an attempt to tarnish the legacy of one of its greatest statesmen.
So what exactly did President Mugabe say?
Well, Mugabe was speaking at a ZANU-PF rally in Gweru on Friday, and he reportedly said Mandela cherished his own personal freedom over the economic freedom of his people. And hence today, more than 20 years after democracy, everything, quote, in South Africa remains in the hands of whites. Now, Mugabe was speaking in Shona, and his comments were translated by local journalists attending the rally. He also reportedly said the most important thing to Mandela was his own release from prison and nothing else, that he cherished that freedom more than anything else and forgot why he was sent to jail in the first place. Now, you'll remember that Mandela spent about 27 years behind bars under the apartheid regime. Controversially, Jackson, Mugabe said that this opinion is commonly held by current government ministers serving in the South African cabinet. Mugabe was in South Africa recently and said he spoke to a government minister who seemed to imply that the current status quo in South Africa was thanks to Mandela's leadership.
And obviously this is not going down well with Mandela's party, the ANC, back in South Africa.
Quite right, Jackson. The ANC has come out strongly, slamming Mugabe's views. ANC Secretary General Gwede Mantashe telling journalists that he phoned his counterpart, the Secretary General of ZANU-PF, to complain about his president's comments. He told the ZANU-PF SG that he needs to rein in Mugabe and remind him that ZANU-PF has in fact presided over the failure of the Zimbabwean economy. Gwede Mantashe also saying that South Africa has created millionaires, including Zimbabwean millionaires, and it's done so without crippling the South African economy. So there was a strong and prompt response from the ANC to what is seen as an attempt to tarnish Mandela's legacy. We had Secretary General Gwede Mantashe coming out and chastising Mugabe, in fact, basically telling him that people in glass houses shouldn't be throwing stones.
Right, Nadia, and even though this is the first time a South African politician has come out so strongly against President Mugabe's comments, this is not the first time that President Mugabe has expressed these kinds of opinions about President Mandela.
True. Mugabe has always made no bones about the fact that he believes Mandela's greatest mistake was ignoring or failing to attend to the land issue after 1994. He believes black people in South Africa have failed to liberate themselves from the effects of apartheid, that white South Africans have had an easy ride since democracy began. And he was saying that white people still own the major businesses and occupy high-powered positions in South Africa. He seems to place the blame for this inequality firmly at the feet of the late Madiba, who he seems to feel focused too much on reconciliation and too little on leveling the playing fields.
That was Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Ongoing protests in Togo this week have drawn attention to what rights groups are saying is a crackdown on freedom of expression in the country, amid reports that protesters arrested last month were ill-treated in detention. Amnesty International West Africa researcher Francois Patuel tells Rikish Ryuk that Togolese authorities need to respect the right to peaceful assembly as protests continue Thursday.
Our observers on site have reported that they've cut the internet, which is a very bad sign. And this is to, you know, you need to put this into the perspective of a general crackdown on protests in Togo. There's been instances of excessive use of force in August, which have left two people killed. There's been political leaders who have been detained, threatened, and ill-treated in the aftermath of the protests in August.
Do you think with the action that was taken on Wednesday by Togo's cabinet to draft the bill to modify the constitution and reintroduce presidential term limits, do you think that will have an effect on the protests or the reaction by the government to the protesters at this moment?
That was one of the calls of the PNP, which is an opposition party. They were calling for the reintroduction of a presidential term limit. Now that the parliament has adopted a draft bill, then, you know, potentially this is one of their calls which has been met. But they've also expressed concerns now about the lack of justice into what happened in previous demonstrations. So, you know, they've had one of their calls which seems to have been met. We need to still see what happens to that bill, and people have to see also what it contains. The future is uncertain.
Why protest now, given that elections aren't scheduled for another 2 years? Presidential elections, anyway.
There are regular protests in Togo, protests against the rise of fuel prices, for instance, which happened in the beginning of the year, which were very violently repressed as well. The military intervened, they used firearms, we found ammunition on sites, and there was one person, at least one person, that was killed earlier in the year. There were protests again in August, mostly organized by the PNP, which is an opposition party, calling for the reintroduction of the presidential term limits, but also expressing concerns about, you know, the crackdown on freedom of expression in Togo in general. You know, it's difficult to have express a critical view of governmental policy in Togo, as freedom of expression can be you know, restricted. Following the protests on the 19th of August, there were a number of arrests, particularly across opposition groups. We recorded at least 66 arrests, and 28 people were sentenced following those protests. Some of the sentences were very heavy. We're talking 60 months of detention. And the concern that we have is that, you know, while demonstrators who have used violence and have committed violence should be held to account, justice should not be instrumentalized to only target people who belong to opposition groups. But many of the people that were arrested following the August protests were ill-treated. Several reported that they were beaten, particularly at the time of arrest, but also in the first few hours of being held in police custody.
That was Francois Patuel, Amnesty International West Africa researcher. He was speaking to Ricky Shryock from Paris. And judicial officers in Uganda have unanimously agreed to suspend their strike until December as they wait the government to fulfill its promises of improving the conditions that judges work in. From Kampala, Uganda, reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report.
In the interest of the administration of justice and under goodwill, we have decided to defer our resolution that triggered the IA or the industrial action to 11th of December of this year so that the executive can fulfill the promises.
That was Godfrey Kaweesa, the chairperson of Uganda's Judicial Officers Association, or UJOA, reading judges' resolutions yesterday in Kampala. Judge Helen Agio, the chief magistrate from Mubende District, says her colleagues, mainly junior officers, go through appalling conditions.
Sometimes they have to ride on border borders for a distance of about 60 kilometers just to go and visit a land dispute, risking their lives without proper security, without proper facilitation. And those are some of the things that have affected the administration of justice.
Justice Minister Kahindo Tafiri told judges in yesterday's meeting that he's well aware of the plight of judges.
So, grade one magistrates, I am going to struggle for you to ensure that you don't become rich, but at least you live. Because as of now, you are surviving, you're not living. You are just surviving, you are not living. How you manage to survive, I don't know. But we're going to make sure that within the means, within our means, and our capacity to pay adequately within the acceptable world parameters, I promise you we're going to do our level best to make sure that you live.
Junior judicial officers in Uganda are paid around 800,000 Uganda shillings, or about $200 per month. Simon Toroko, grade 1 magistrate from the Western Uganda's district of Kagadi, says citizens have suffered enough because of the ongoing strike.
I am of the view that to save our people, countryside, we need to reach consensus and go back and give them services. The reason why I'm saying so, I for one and others, we are also facing the same problem. We have people, countryside, our relatives are asking us, what is happening with you people? Why don't you dialogue with the government such that you can serve us?
Judges in Uganda have been on sit-down strike since July 24th, demanding for increased pay, transport and accommodation allowances, as well as security. Kaweesa agrees with Toroko.
There is outcry in the police cells. People's rights have been violated. People have overstayed in detention over and above what is provided for in the constitution, the 48-hour rule. The courts generate revenue. Therefore, they have not been able to generate revenue to add revenue to the economy of the country, because we generate revenue through fines and the like. And then investor confidence has been affected. The world over is reading about industrial action by an arm of government in Uganda.
He also says there have been an increase in crime rate in the country since the strike began. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
The regional mediated inter-Burundi dialogue is set to resume next month in Arusha. This comes after the Burundi ombudsman met with the facilitator, former Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa, who in efforts to open up space for an all-inclusive dialogue on a crisis that has plagued the country for the last 2 years. Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura.
On his arrival at Bujumbura International Airport after the 3 days meeting with former Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa, who is the facilitator of the inter-Burundi dialogue, the Burundi ombudsman Edward Nduwimana said that those who are under arrest warrants won't be able to participate in what could be the last session of the regional mediated dialogue and urged on the facilitator to conclude the dialogue before the end of this year.
We agreed that the facilitator will differentiate between those who are wanted by the justice and those who are not, because in Burundi politics, those who are under arrest warrants are the minority. So now he will differentiate between the groups and those who are under arrest warrants should face justice or ask for forgiveness.
The regional mediated dialogue was suspended more than 5 times since the political crisis erupted in Burundi in 2015 after the incumbent president Pierre Nkurunziza vied for a third term, which opposition say was unconstitutional. The Burundi government had since then been reluctant to sit with some opposition leaders it accuses of plotting the 2015 failed coup. The Burundi opposition leader and deputy speaker of the parliament, Agathon Rwasa, says that all Burundians have the right to participate in the dialogue.
If we want to make peace, after all, we must give up some of the so-called claims from this and that other one. How can we pretend that we can make peace? Why we still persecute people just because of their political belonging or thinking? And I'm also convinced that the problems of Burundi must be solved by Burundians, all Burundians. Nobody is to be excluded.
The office of the facilitator, Benjamin Mkapa, had called on the Burundi government to release political prisoners and also lift arrest warrants to some opposition leaders who are believed of not taking part in the failed coup. As the regional mediated dialogue is set to conduct its final consultations focused on the roadmap towards the 2020 general elections, the National Dialogue Commission that was formed by President Pierre Nkurunziza had earlier this year presented the final report to the parliament, highlighting Burundians' call to amend the constitution in order to scrap the term limits. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
And that's it for this Thursday, September the 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you all in Africa a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, fresh off a three-nation Africa visit to the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zambia, and Tanzania, Shaka Sali talks about the fascinating people he met and the challenges he encountered, reporting on democracy in Africa. On the Road with Shaka, on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.